From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A trade war between the world's two largest economies has officially begun as the Trump administration follows through with its threat to impose tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese products, an escalation of a conflict that could hurt companies and consumers in both the United States and China and other countries as well. U.S. intelligence services are reporting that North Korea continues to advance and develop its nuclear weapons program, a revelation that looms large as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visits North Korea to begin the process of bringing clarity to the broad agreement made between the two countries in Singapore. President Trump has reportedly narrowed his list of candidates to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy to three in advance of announcing his choice early next week. Meanwhile, the Democratic opposition is still struggling to unite on a strategy to handle a nomination that could tip the court to the right on a number of crucial issues. And embattled Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt resigned after yet another investigation into his conduct in office was initiated. So, folks, let's start off this busy week with China tariffs. It's being called potentially the largest trade war in history. Tom, I want to start with you. What are the tariffs that the U.S. has imposed on the Chinese economy, and why at this particular level in these particular products?
Well, I think that the reason he's started out low is because I think he thinks this is the opening gambit of a negotiation on trade and on tariffs. Because when he was traveling the country in the last few days, President Trump said, "I have a $500 billion in additional tariffs that I'm ready to impose in addition to these, unless the Chinese," now I'm paraphrasing, "unless the Chinese do the right thing." $500 billion is a pretty big number. Put another way, it's $1 trillion in tariffs that he's threatening to impose. Now, the Chinese hit back to the 34 from the 34 million that the president has already imposed by imposing $34 million in tariffs of their own on soybeans, corn, pork, and poultry. And it's, you can be sure the Chinese well understand that those are commodities that hit President Trump in his conservative breadbasket in places like Iowa and Nebraska and Kansas, Republican territory. And I think those particular commodities were a signal from the Chinese: look, Mr. President, you want to play hardball? We can play hardball as well.
I mean, speaking of hardball, the state-run China Daily newspaper said in an English language edition on Friday, in effect, the Trump administration is behaving like a gang of hoodlums with its shakedown of other countries, particularly China. And that's the type of language, Tracy, that really gets the president going.
It's almost like that's like something you would see on the North Korean website before the most recent thaw of relations. I mean, that's not usually what you see from the Chinese.
No, it really isn't. And we'll get to the North Koreans because it all, of course, meshes together in other issues. But let's talk about the economics still before we get to the politics. How are those tariffs playing out in the United States and in China?
Well, of course, it's early days, but I think we're going to see unintended consequences. I think you'll see prices going up for consumers, both here and in China, here in the United States and in China. And eventually, if this were to go on for a long time, you would see jobs being cut, even industries being hurt. I think recent history, when there has been a trade war over sanctions like this, it's really hurt a lot of U.S. industry. I guess what we don't know is how far Trump will be willing to go, how far China will go, or is this all just, you know, a negotiating tactic, and Trump expects China to come to its knees and then make trade what he would consider more fair to the United States.
And when we talk about the politics of this, and President Trump calls himself a free trader, this is, I guess it depends how you define the term free trader. Politically, how is this playing out within the party and within his base? As Tom alluded to, there's a danger with the retaliatory tariffs hitting squarely in the base of the Trump voters. How are they responding?
Right. It's going to be hitting his base. And even within the Republican Party, a lot of people are opposed to this kind of action. So Trump does not have a lot of support for it. It's unclear at what point his base will see that they're being hurt by this. They tend not to hold him accountable for a lot of these issues. There's another unintended consequence that I wanted to bring up, and that is on the political side. There are foreign policy implications. Trump is in this war with China, a country he very much needs to help him on North Korea. China is North Korea's biggest ally, biggest trade partner, and the one country probably in the world that can really make North Korea do what it asks. And to be waging war with China when you need China to help you doesn't seem like a smart way to go, and there could be repercussions there.
I think that's a really, really good point. How do you handle the balancing act of conducting a trade war with China while you're suing for peace with North Korea? Seems to be a very delicate balance there.
I mean, I think it's hard to compartmentalize like that, Michael. The Chinese are proud. They're tough. They're defiant. They think, rightly or wrongly, that they have the United States on the run globally. They believe that the United States is not going to react to the Chinese, what I would call the militarization of the Pacific. But so I don't think the Chinese are prepared to take a lot of whatever from President Trump. And I think they think the tariffs are inappropriate and wrong and punitive and ill-advised. And I don't think we're in this situation where Trump and President Xi of China are saying to each other, you know, we got to do what we got to do, but it's not a big problem here that we just have to do this for domestic consumption. I don't believe that. I think President Trump has started down a road that could be far more complicated than maybe he thinks.
Well, as all experts agree, at $34 billion per side, it's pretty much kabuki theater. But when we get to the numbers that we're talking about in terms of $500, $600 trillion, then
yeah,
you're really...
I said $34 million earlier, but obviously it's $34
billion. Yeah.
That's still not as nearly as much as a half a trillion that President Trump has in the back of his holster.
Let's move from there to the subject that you've already alluded to, which is the North Korea situation. The U.S. intelligence reports that the North Koreans are continuing with elements of their nuclear weapons program. The timing for the revelation is interesting as Secretary Pompeo negotiates disarmament with the North Koreans. President Trump has declared that the threat from the North Koreans was gone. This seems to be somewhat in doubt at this point. Tracy, what exactly are the allegations? What are the elements of the program that the North Koreans are not giving up and are continuing to develop?
This is based on satellite imagery, and it appears that they continue to expand and enhance and improve and build on a couple of ballistic missile sites and nuclear sites. Now, some experts will say, well, this doesn't necessarily mean they'll never denuclearize, but it certainly does fly in the face of what President Trump claimed, that North Korea no longer poses a nuclear threat. And more important, I think, is that this underscores how vague that first commitment, that Singapore summit agreement last month was. It said virtually nothing. The two sides agreed to, quote unquote, work toward denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which would affect U.S. presence as well. But anyway, there are no details in that. And so Pompeo is in Pyongyang now, his third trip there, and is trying to get, you know, the barest minimum sketching of a timeline, of an inventory, any of those things, if he could come away with, would be an improvement. But I think we see that this is all still very tentative, a very fragile process.
Tom, I love your way of strategically thinking. If I was going to run for office, you'd be my chief of staff, probably.
You'd be in far more trouble than you are today, Michael.
I doubt that, my friend. I doubt that. But thinking strategically, why do these leaks come out now? Because presumably this is information that the U.S. has had for some time.
Right.
Is this intentional? Is it meant to be an intimidation tactic against the North Koreans?
I think that's part of it, Michael. I think President Trump wants the North Koreans to know, we've got satellites, we've got other means of intelligence, and we know what you're up to. We know you're not dismantling all your programs, and we also know that you think that you can hide stuff, continue to hide stuff, and but that's not working. So I think that's part of it.
So you can't hide from us. There's nothing that you know that we can't know.
Exactly right. And I think the North Koreans, are probably saying, you're not as smart as you think you are. We know what we're doing. But here's the important point, I think an important point, and I'm mangling my metaphors, but I'm going to do it anyway. Look at the legislative history of this relationship over 20 years, 30 years between Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather. The North Koreans have agreed to do things, and then they change their mind. They renege. And it turns out after they've gotten this enticement or that enticement, they bow out or they get caught with their hand in the nuclear cookie jar, so to speak. And so I think this is kind of genetic in the North Korean DNA.
Tracy, I'm going to ask you, to speculate on this, why do you think there hasn't been a direct comment from President Trump on these revelations of an apparent sort of conflict of what the North Koreans said they were going to do and what they're doing?
That's a good question. And I wonder, just to play devil's advocate, if the intelligence community, with whom Trump does not have the best relationship, didn't leak these revelations to deliberately point out that Trump is wrong when he says there's no nuclear threat. It also helps to reduce expectations that Trump himself is fanning, but that can kind of bring everyone a little bit back to earth. I don't know why Trump has not commented on it. He often does not comment on things he doesn't have an answer for or doesn't really like to hear, but yet we may see something. Pompeo is also over there right now, so perhaps for once Trump is learning to sort of keep his peace for now.
Somebody's got the cell phone. Somebody's got the cell phone. Let's take a break right there, and we'll be back with more of Issues in the News.
Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab at our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
The announcement of the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy was made last week, and President Trump has announced that there are now three candidates that are reported to be the leading candidates. They are appeals court judges Brett Kavanaugh, Raymond Kethledge, and Amy Coney Barrett. Tracy, has anyone of those three emerged as the front runner?
I think so. From what we hear and are being told, Brett Kavanaugh is the front runner. Kethledge also, they both clerked for Kennedy, so that gives them a track record of sorts. They both have long experience in the judiciary. But I think Brett Kavanaugh is leading right now. He seems to get good marks from the conservative groups that he needs to, and yet he's not seen as an extremist. I think Barrett might have fallen out because I think the administration might have realized her confirmation process would be a very tough fight. And I think Kavanaugh and Kethledge are more palatable to the Democratic opposition, which will be fierce regardless, given that there is so much at stake. But I would say these two men leading with Kavanaugh are the leading candidates now.
Tom, how has the selection process for the Trump administration differed, if it has at all, has it differed from the selection process from other administrations?
Well, I think what's been happening in the Trump administration is they outsource the selection process to the very conservative Federalist Society, of which several Supreme Court justices, past and present, have been members.
Heritage Foundation also, who's had a lot of input.
Right,
into
exactly
that.
Right. But basically, the Republicans, for a long time, especially the entire 8 years of the Obama administration, have been putting together a portfolio of possible Supreme Court justices for the next Republican president, and they have vetted them. And I believe the short list of candidates, which until recently was allegedly 15 and is now narrowed to 3, I think the president's patrons and staff members are very confident that whoever he picks from this list will be a solid conservative, probably prepared to at least think about rolling back Roe versus Wade, the abortion case. And so I think basically the White House knows what they're going to get with all of these nominees. The real question about Kavanaugh, and I agree with Tracy that it just looks like Trump is salivating to name him. The only downside is that he worked for George W. Bush, and anything Bush is just anathema to President Trump. He loathes the Bushes, 41 and 43, and they loathe him.
Yeah.
And so there was an interesting story last week. Reportedly, President Trump has been calling conservative friends and asking him, what about the fact that he worked for George W. Bush?
Yeah.
And I suspect they're being told he's a reliable conservative, don't worry about it.
Which is not necessarily the best thing to be
right.
in the Trump administration.
Right. The other thing quickly is that he wrote an article, I think, for the Minnesota Law Review or some. There was a Minnesota connection where he was basically arguing long before the Trump administration that presidents should not have to worry about nuisances like testifying in civil suits or criminal suits. They've got the weight of the world on their shoulders. And one would think that that's going to come up in confirmation hearings if it is Kavanaugh, because basically if you believed what Kavanaugh wrote several years ago, he's giving any president a pass until after he's out of office.
Right.
And which is fairly breathtaking.
It's significant.
And Trump, you can be sure, knows this and loves that notion.
I'm sure it came up in those one-on-one meetings that the president had. There's been much gnashing of teeth on the Democratic side about this nomination, which hasn't even happened. We don't even have a candidate yet. But there's been a lot of talk about what the options are for the Democrats, either to forestall the confirmation hearings until the midterms and or the process of trying to push back on a nomination that might be seen as too extreme, given the fact that one of President Trump's major roles within his base is to tweak Democrats. If that extremist candidate comes up, do the Democrats really have any practical solutions to push back?
I don't think so. They have to make a calculation of whether it's better to delay the confirmation process or do it before the midterms, because the question is, does this bring out more conservative voters if the seat is not yet filled or if it's filled? So that's the calculation they have to make. But the opposition party does believe to an extent that a president has a right to pick his justices. So it'll depend how extreme the candidate is. But the Democrats aren't united on this. Some would even vote for his candidate. So it's difficult for me to see how they will come up with any real solution or counter strategy.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's any real parliamentary solution to that problem, mm-hmm. given the way the vote structure is.
No.
Just a real quick yes-no question. It's going to be a tough one for you. This justice could possibly hear cases on the ability of a president to be indicted or to pardon himself. It's a possibility. Yes or no? Should a justice appointed by President Trump recuse his or herself from any cases that have to do with the president?
Absolutely yes.
Yes.
All right. Good. Yes or no? Got it. Let's go on to Scott Pruitt, the former Environmental Protection Agency, and I noticed that even the mention of the name brings a wry smile to everyone in the room. A brief history of Scott Pruitt's term includes somewhere around 19 investigations, and we like to talk of the sports fans about records that will never be broken, and this may be among them. I got to say, Tom, you know the history of Washington very well. Has there ever been an administration official who has faced this much scrutiny, both serious and like tragicomic?
No. I mean, I've been covering the White House for 50 years, and I can never remember. I mean, there's nobody even close to Scott Pruitt in terms of being as personally corrupt in ways large and small and ridiculous as Scott Pruitt. And if he were not working for President Trump, he would have been gone a year ago. To say he's missing an ethical gene or two is a gross understatement. Time after time, and he has gotten in trouble for insisting on flying first class because he feared for his life, to having a lobbyist help try to arrange a $200,000 job for his wife, which she did not get, but she got one for a while for less money. To I think my personal favorite is the asking aides to go find his favorite hand lotion from a Ritz-Carlton hotel. Using aides for all manner of trying to help him do this and that have nothing to do with government function. I mean, he is a, I mean, I can't resist. I mean, for somebody running the EPA, he was a walking environmental toxic waste dump. And it's breathtaking.
It really is.
That he has been able to survive so long. But
I would ask that question of Tracy, though. How did he last so long?
You didn't even mention the soundproof
$43,000 soundproof booth
in his
booth.
Office. What did he need that for? That's my question. No, it is remarkable, even for President Trump, that Pruitt lasted as long as he did. I think one reason, well, the big reason, of course, is that he was eliminating regulations on the environment, on clean air and water, which Trump very much liked. So he was carrying forth Trump's agenda. So that bought him a lot of time. And I think Trump also sort of digs his heels in sometimes when he sees a campaign, what he would see as a campaign to get rid of one of his people.
He's a loyal aide, a loyal associate.
Completely loyal. And I don't know if you read Pruitt's resignation letter. He continued to fawn on President Trump about what an honor it had been to serve him. And he made no apology for any of these scandals and allegations of misdeeds. He, in fact, said it was all personal attacks on him. And so... As you said, Tom, no ethical gene to be found there, and I think Trump just kept him on as long as he could to continue his agenda.
But that's so ironic as well, Lynn, and I agree with that. Tracy, excuse me. I'm sorry, Tracy, but he will now be succeeded by his deputy, Andrew Wheeler, a former coal industry lobbyist, and so Wheeler will almost certainly continue all the policies that Pruitt had promulgated, and
so you get all of the policy with none of the scandal.
Exactly.
Presumably,
right.
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
So how does that explain how long Pruitt lasted? And I think it's because Trump is very concerned about keeping his base in lockstep, and Pruitt is very popular with the base.
And Wheeler was only recently confirmed, I believe. So you know he did have to wait. Trump did have to wait for Wheeler to be in place before he could remove Pruitt.
A statistic, 61% turnover in the administration in 18 months. 61%. By contrast, and not to say whether that's a good or bad thing, about 5% in the first Obama administration in the first 18 months. So considering that Scott Pruitt has lasted for this long, there are a number of others in the administration, I think, who are at least on the proverbial hot seat. Any predictions about who's next?
Well, I don't think so, because I guess whoever he or she might be, you could now cite the Pruitt rule. I mean, I'm not nearly as
I like that the
as,
Pruitt rule
as venal as Scott Pruitt, and look how long he survived. I mean, there've got to be some here or there, but one doesn't come to mind.
Tracy, anyone for you?
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is frequently mentioned. Chief of Staff John Kelly is frequently mentioned. But I agree. I don't think we can predict. You know, people are up and down at a whim sometimes, and so it's hard to say.
And, nope. I don't think either Kelly or Sessions, if they go, and they probably will at some point, have ethical issues. Basically, it's Trump's antipathy towards Sessions goes way back to when he recused himself from overseeing the Robert Mueller investigation. And Kelly has been up and down. The word in the White House has been for weeks that Kelly would be gone by the end of the summer. And a White House aide on Air Force One asked the president about that about a week ago, and he said that's not true and it's just more fake news.
Well, the saying goes that anyone in any administration serves at the pleasure of the president, and I think that phrase has never been more true than in the current administration. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.